Welcome to Our Missouri, a podcast about the people, places, culture, and history of the 114 counties and independent city of St. Louis that comprise the great state of Missouri. Each episode focuses on a topic related to the state, ranging from publications about Missouri's history to current projects undertaken by organizations to preserve and promote local institutions. The Our Missouri podcast is recorded at the Center for Missouri Studies in Columbia and is generously provided to you by the State Historical Society of Missouri. And now, here's your host, Sean Ross.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, or whatever hour you're tuning in to listen to the Our Missouri podcast. My name is Sean Ross, and I'll be your guide as we explore the memories, moments, and misfortunes from Our Missouri. Welcome back to our series On the Bookshelf, where we explore new books in Missouri history. We are joined today by Matthew C. Hulbert. He holds a PhD in history from the University of Georgia and presently serves as an associate professor of history at Hampden-Sydney College. He is the author and editor of several books, including The Civil War Guerrilla, Unfolding the Black Flag in History, Memory, and Myth, The Ghosts of Guerrilla Memory, How Civil War Bushwhackers Became Gunslingers in the American West, Writing History with Lightning, Cinematic Representations in 19th Century America, Martial Culture Silver Screen, War Movies and the Construction of American Identity, and his new book, Oracle of Lost Causes, John Newman Edwards and His Never-Ending Civil War. Matt joins us today to talk about his new book and about the legacy and memory of John Newman Edwards. Welcome to Our Missouri, Matt.
I appreciate you having me. Thank you very much.
Now let's dive into this new book here. Talk a little bit about the origins of it. Where does this idea come from? Where does this theme come from for you?
Sure. So this was actually a project long in the making before it was actually in the making. I've been working on Civil War guerrillas in Missouri, and specifically the way that guerrillas have been remembered and the way those memory narratives have intersected with broader Southern, particularly Democratic politics in the, you know, the latter end of the 19th century and the early 20th century. And John Newman Edwards, who's the subject of this new book, has loomed large in all of those subtopics because he's the guy who made guerrillas, guerrillas, as we remember them by and large, especially in Missouri. But in graduate school, for various reasons, and through sage advice from my doctoral advisor, John Insko, I did not attempt to write this book as a dissertation, which it would have been a disaster. I was probably not ready to write this kind of book. It was an immense research project. It was supposed to take 3 years. It ended up taking 5 years. We can blame COVID a little bit for that, but most of it was probably just me. So, you know, this was sort of the culmination of previous work that helped lay the groundwork and get me ready for this. But it really goes back to, if we're going to origins, I've always been a big fan of Western movies and Western mythology and Western lore, and the Jameses and the Youngers are a major part of that in American folk history. So imagine my surprise when I show up as a master's student at NC State and start looking into their backstory and realize they were actually diehard Confederate guerrillas. And the answer immediately popped into my head. How come nobody remembers them that way? Why do we think of them as cowboys and gunslingers and Western bandits? All of those trails led right back to John Newman Edwards, because he's the guy who sort of curated their images and the way we remember them. Little did I know, all these years later, that would actually be the backdrop to this much, much, much larger story about 19th century America and the Civil War and its legacy.
In thinking about this book, obviously, to kind of construct a story about someone's life, to kind of get into the context of that, you have to get into the archives, you have to get into those materials to kind of build up that information to kind of provide the research basis for you. For someone like Edwards, who is writing on a regular basis, obviously you can draw from that, but talk a little bit about the archives and the resources you had to go through and really examine to help develop this book.
Sure. So he's sort of scattered all over the place, which is surprising for a man of letters. Edwards wrote untold newspaper columns. He's a fairly prolific correspondent. Not as much of that has survived as you might have imagined. And then he's the author of three books. So there's quite a large public record of him, but most of that exists in the published primary realm. So when you're getting into archival collections that have to do with Edwards, it's really mostly archival collections that have to do with the people whose legends he's creating or the people whose stories he's weaving together into this broader narrative. Now, there are some great ones, especially in Colombia, tied directly to Edwards. The letters that he writes home to his sisters while he's in Mexican exile, for instance, give this perfect lens into what his mindset is at the time, what he thinks the Confederados are actually going to be doing in Mexico, how long he thinks he's going to be there, and frankly, how detached he's become from reality at this point, because his political predictions for Maximilian's long-term survival there, and then by extension, the Confederados' long-term survival there, are not great. But aside from letters and some of the trial documents having to do with the duel that he fought, and then a few of the trial documents from his involvement in Frank James's legal affairs later in the 1880s, he leaves a surprisingly light personal archival footprint. But luckily for him, because I joke, he is the Forrest Gump of the Civil War and the Trans-Mississippi. There's plenty of archival footprint to go around with Joe Shelby and the Jameses and Sterling Price and all of the Quantrill, all of the other people that he's involved in. So the research trips for this book were really sort of an interesting oddity of almost pinballing from one archive to the other, following clues, following scraps, picking up his trail where possible. But there was always a lot of space to fill in around him, because he was never a guy who specifically wrote about himself or put himself in the limelight, which was good and bad when trying to tell his story.
I love a good hook, something to draw the reader in, something to catch your attention. And especially with your book, that opening kind of elements of explaining not only a little bit about John Newman Edwards, who he was, but also kind of that era that he came of age in, really kind of encapsulating that period of the 1850s leading up to the Civil War. Take us through a little bit of that. Kind of introduce us to John Newman Edwards.
John Newman Edwards, who I call John just out of habit now. So please don't think that's odd. Excuse me for that. We spent a lot of time together. So we're on a first name basis. But John is born in 1838 in Warren County, Virginia. He's part of an interesting family in the sense that his lineage ties together many of the most aristocratic old family names of Virginia, but like so many of those families, they've become threadworn by the time we get to the middle of the 19th century, and they just don't have any money left. So John is born into kind of a lower middle class situation, but his father is a man on the rise. He invests in a successful tannery. He's investing in real estate. He's becoming an increasingly large figure in the local church there. So for all intents and purposes, it really looks like John Sr., who's our John's father, is going to start restoring the family to prominence. And then when John is just 5 years old, his father is struck down by a mysterious illness. He dies, and it leaves John's mother to care for four children, one of whom is actually born after the death of her father. So they're going to have to deal with poverty for most of John's childhood. And you couple that poverty with the turbulent era that he's growing up in. A lot of people listening to this can probably remember what was going on around the time they turned 18 years old. I guarantee you, it probably wasn't as tumultuous a time as what John was coming of age in. You've got Lawrence, Kansas being sacked. You've got Margaret Garner trying to dispatch her own children because she believes they're better off dead than as slaves. You have Charles Sumner being beat nearly to death on the floor of Congress. And then you've got John Brown responding in kind with a broadsword. So this is when the sectional crisis is really starting to boil over. And I make the point in the book that the sectional crisis is essentially John's cradle. So as he emerges from his childhood and walks out into the world as an adult, he's coming into the world that the sectional crisis has created, just as it stops being a crisis and it starts becoming the war that the crisis has created. So he is very well educated for a child that lacked the financial means as he did. He's got a classical education. And when you combine his education and his love of ancient literature and medieval literature and mythology with the fact that he was orphaned at such a young age, this really goes a long way in explaining his personality. He is a very nostalgic, backward-looking child. He's always sort of hearkening back to this version of the old world that had never really existed, but it's kings and queens, it's absolute monarchs, it's knights and damsels, it's courtly love, it's warriors' codes of honor, it's gentlemen. Everybody knows their place. It's a binary power arrangement, and it's really going to be his life's mission to try to bring that world into being, to try to will that world through his writing and the things he does on the battlefield and through the way he manipulates politics to try to will that world into reality. He's never going to actually be able to do it because it had never existed in the first place. This will contribute to a drinking problem that he has by the time he's in late adulthood. John has a severe problem with alcohol. And you can sort of see the way this becomes a vicious cycle. He can't create the world around him that he'd like to see, so he drinks. The more that he drinks, the easier it is to live vicariously through this world that he creates on the page. The more he lives vicariously through that world, the more he pulls back from society and kind of lives within his own mind. Eventually, the alcohol is what will kill him, but before it gets him, he manages to create an awful lot that we're still reckoning with today. His legacy from 19th century America, and especially the war, a lot of the questions he was forcing people to grapple with then, we're still trying to answer now. We don't necessarily always recall that we're in conversation with him, but we are.
Now, you kind of note early on in the book that Edwards might be considered what you call a B-list celebrity in terms of the Civil War era compared to more notable figures like an Abraham Lincoln or Robert E. Lee. You could even say perhaps a Stonewall Jackson or someone like that. Yet he seemingly, as you're going through this book, made endless connections with a wide variety of individuals and groups. I'm curious to kind of find out more, and certainly for the listeners to find out more about his connections to people like, you know, Joe Shelby, his time, as you kind of alluded to earlier, in Mexico, and even, of course, the more prominently known connections with Jesse James and the James Gang and the Youngers.
Yeah, so when John first moves to Missouri in the mid-1850s, one of the first people he befriends is Joe Shelby. Shelby comes from, Joseph Orville Shelby, I should say, when we first introduce him. He comes from an aristocratic, old, very wealthy Kentucky family. Shelby set himself up in Western Missouri as a hemp and shipping magnate. He's been involved in the border war. He's led incursions across the Kansas border. And when John first meets him, he is sort of the iconic Southern cavalier. He's really the closest thing John's ever seen to one of his Arthurian heroes in the flesh. So he immediately gravitates towards Shelby. They become best friends, they're drinking buddies, they're hunting buddies. And when Shelby goes off to war, essentially bankrolling his own cavalry company, John goes with him. And as that company becomes a regiment, and then later the famed Iron Brigade that helps Shelby invade Missouri, is with him every step of the way, serving as his adjutant for most of the war. And then after the war, he will be the one who creates and then largely controls and curates Shelby's historical legacy and then also his commemorative legacy. He writes a book about Shelby during the war. He writes a book about Shelby's expedition to Mexico, and he really solidifies Shelby as probably the war soldier that Missouri has to offer. Sterling Price might be rolling in his grave a little bit there. But when we look at them doing more worthwhile work with the Confederate command structure than Price is, when he goes to Mexico after the war, and they do this largely because they initially want Edmund Kirby Smith to concede command of the Department of the Trans-Mississippi to someone else who's willing to continue the war effort from Texas, even after Appomattox. There's a group of these hardcore Trans-Miss guys who are not interested and giving up. That scheme falls through, so they go into Mexican exile. They initially pledge their services to Emperor Maximilian and his wife, Empress Charlotte. And Maximilian, not that he's any great political thinker, but even he realizes this would essentially be political suicide if he accepts this group of ex-Confederate mercenaries who had these unreconstructed rebels as mercenary forces, almost like another foreign legion in a sense. So he tells them, I can't do that because your American government would be down on me like a sack of bricks. But what I can do is subsidize land for you. I can set you guys up in a subsidized colony and we'll see what happens, because Maximilian is just thrilled to have other white people in Mexico. He's not popular with native Mexicans. He has deposed the rightfully elected president, Benito Juarez. And frankly, the Foreign Legion is really the only thing keeping him in power. This is why the situation is sort of so odd in Mexico. Maximilian is an Austrian Habsburg. He is actually the younger brother of the emperor of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. His wife, Empress Charlotte, is Belgian. She's the sister of King Leopold II, known more for his cruelties in the Congo than anything else. But they are serving as puppet monarchs on behalf of Napoleon III of France. So it's this whole imperial soap opera that Edwards and Shelby insert themselves into. And in the process of running coffee plantation and founding and then running an English language newspaper for other confederados, Edwards manages to become infatuated. We might even say he falls in love with Empress Charlotte. But in true John fashion, it's because he views her as the embodiment of this imaginary old world. She's beautiful. She plays instruments. She speaks multiple languages. She's educated. He really sees he's attracted to her in sort of a medieval courtly way, not in a lustful way. And she becomes the emblem of this world that he's hoping they can recreate in Mexico, because they were not able to recreate it in the Old South. For Edwards, Mexico is not just biding time. It's not just escaping Reconstruction. It's not just getting away from emancipation. If the Confederacy, the original Confederate experiment, had been for him to try to reestablish this old world, this hyper-traditional, hyper-conservative old world, that fails. But then in Mexico, he gets a do-over or a mulligan. And this time he thinks they can really do it, because they don't have to deal with Jeff Davis. They don't have to worry about a president or about a Congress or anything like that. They've got an emperor and they've got a Habsburg emperor. So he really thinks it's going to work this time. And then, of course, it doesn't. Maximilian ends up on the wrong end of a firing squad. They have to come back to the United States. And this puts John in a very select group of men who experience Confederate defeat twice. Now, when he gets back, to answer the third part of your question, John throws himself into anti-Reconstruction, anti-radical, anti-Grant politics. And the cleverest way he figures out to do that is to use this group of guerrillas turned bandits led by Frank and Jesse James. It also includes the Younger Brothers and a number of other former bushwhackers who have taken to robbing banks and then later trains. He weaponizes them and he turns them into poster children for radical Reconstruction's corruption and for how it's mistreating these fine young boys, as he pitches them, who wanted nothing more than to just go home and farm with their mother. But unionists and these dastardly Republicans won't let them do it. So they were forced to turn to crime. They have this Robin Hood turn, and he's ghostwriting articles for them. He's ghostwriting letters. He really becomes the PR man for what turns out to be the most famous criminal enterprise of the 19th century in all of the United States. But just to give you a glimpse of how shrewd he is as a political operator, once Reconstruction's over and they're no longer useful, he just drops them. He immediately moves on. They're no longer useful. Jesse James doesn't live all that much longer. Edwards does reemerge in Frank James's life to help negotiate his surrender and then his legal troubles. But for John, it's really moving from one phase to the next of that original mission that we talked about. And as each phase brings him disappointment or brings him failure, he becomes a little more desperate, trying to will this imaginary world into being. And this is also when we start to see him getting into the alcohol. He hasn't hit his peak yet as a writer, but as soon as he does, it's going to be downhill pretty quick.
And thinking about John Newman Edwards' life and his death and kind of the legacy of that, since that moment, since his passing, how have scholars in the general public, even up to today, thought of him and interpret him and kind of constructed that historical memory of him?
Well, in a lot of ways, they haven't remembered him, or he's not well known to the public. There's a small group of scholars who work in the borderlands and specifically in Civil War era Missouri who can't escape from Edwards because he establishes Shelby as we know him. He establishes the James Younger Gang as we know him. He establishes Confederate guerrillas in Missouri, revolving around guys like Quantrill or Bloody Bill Anderson or George Todd or William H. Gregg or Arch Clements, really kind of the best known of the Missouri bushwhacker. He makes those guys, but this is a case of him really being the man behind the curtain. We remember all of his creations, and around the time he was creating them, he did achieve that B-level celebrity or that B-list fame. But as decades go on and his creations became immortal, he fades from view. And normally, that wouldn't be what you were looking for in the subject of a biography. And I joke that, you know, this wasn't a lot of fun to explain to my editor the first time, hey, I've got this guy nobody's ever heard of that I want to write this big biography of. But in his case, this actually ends up being sort of like his superpower. Because he's not A-list famous, because he's not Robert E. Lee or U.S. Grant or Lincoln or even a Custer or a John Brown, he achieves lower levels of fame in so many different areas. And as a result of that, he's able to weave together this much broader narrative, this grand tapestry of 19th century America. There aren't a lot of other characters who could tie together generals, bandits, guerrilla chiefs, newspaper editors, pundits, monarchs. But because he's in the background of all these stories, he's able to tether them together in a way that gives us the opportunity to tell this much broader story about the Civil War and Reconstruction. It's bigger geographically, it's bigger chronologically, and the stakes of the conflict are much higher because of how Edwards viewed the importance of the West as sort of the ultimate goal of winning the war, but also how he conceptualized the war within this broader conflict, conservatism against modernity throughout the Western world. So this was a long-winded way of saying the historical memory of John Newman Edwards is really the historical memory of the things he created and the things that we're still dealing with or grappling with or in conversation with, but not necessarily conscious that it was him, that he started the conversation, or that we're still talking to him.
Finally, what do you hope that readers take away from your book? What's the main themes you want them to kind of come away with?
One of them is that the traditional war doesn't have to go away just because we start to expand its parameters. We can have a war that was fought to preserve slavery, but also to control the future of the vast West. We can have a war that decided very important issues domestically within the United States, but that some of its participants understood as being part of this broader international conflict about egalitarianism and all these various political isms that John basically spends his life trying to hold back as the 19th century comes to a close. But, you know, what's probably going to hit closest to home for most readers, especially those who are interested in 19th century history and the Civil War, what I would ask readers to think about is when we ask ourselves questions about the legacy of the Civil War, or what sort of violence did we deem acceptable, irregular, regular, civilized, savage? When we ask ourselves questions about where the Civil War took place and why it mattered and why it still defines our daily lives, we don't necessarily know it, but those are all questions that, because of his work in the 1860s and 70s and 80s, John Newman Edwards forced Americans in his own time to answer differently. And we've been dealing with the fallout of how they dealt with his questions and the answers they had to formulate ever since. So when I say that Edwards' story, when he's the Forrest Gump of the Trans-Mississippi who weaves together this huge collage of 19th century America, this isn't just a book about the world that created John Newman Edwards, and it's not just a book about the world that destroyed him as he was trying to reshape it. This is really the story of us and how we got to where we are today, and how those same pitfalls that eventually destroyed John Newman Edwards could destroy us too, if we're not careful.
Well, thank you very much for joining me today, Matt.
Thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to the Our Missouri Podcast. If you would like to learn more about the podcast, including past and future episodes, information about guests and upcoming events, please visit our website at shsmo.org/our-Missouri.